Welcome to the Word Theater Short Story Podcast, your weekly access to the greatest short stories read by the greatest actors and recorded live in the U.S. and the U.K. My name is Cedaring Fox. I'm Word Theater's founder and artistic director.
And I'm Kirsty Peart, U.K. founder and creative partner.
Stories entertain and enlighten, but at their best they do more because they expand our horizons and connect us. This week, 20 years after 9/11, we bring you a powerful story by Lionel Shriver. After you've listened to this wonderful reading by Elizabeth McGovern, we will share a few words from our author.
Dear Sarah, I apologize for the formality of a letter, but I can't trust myself to get this out over a glass of wine, especially while still unsure what I want to say. Trust that I've treasured your friendship always. On that hiking trip through the Sinai Desert when we all met, what brought our two couples together was a shared disinclination to complain. Other tourists whine ceaselessly about the heat and the food, but we four were intrepid. When you broke out in suppurating cold sores from too much sun, despite the injury to your vanity, you trooped on as if nothing was the matter. Consequently, I'd hate for this letter itself to seem a complaint. But then maybe it is a complaint. Your husband died in 9/11. My husband died on 9/11. So much has ensued from those prepositions. A single one-letter variation in the alphabet. Oddly, your story is at least as vivid to me as my own, since I've heard you recount it so many times at dinner parties. It's the story everyone wants to hear. How the offices of David's investment bank had only recently moved to the 89th floor. A step up in every sense, but if only they'd stayed on the 37th, David would probably have survived. That day brambled with if-onlys. PA announcement that everyone in the South Tower should return to their desks, which lost 7 precious minutes to escape before the second plane hit. Your final conversation with your husband. His report that the only working stairwell was billowing with smoke. His intention to head with several dozen others to the roof, the door to the roof, being locked, though you only learned that later. The helicopters that never came. Yet, I've told my story seldom. It didn't feed local appetites. So allow me this once. In New York, there are thousands of stories like David's now, but only one of Paul's. Like you, I remember the most mundane details of that morning. As usual, Paul had to be at Shiso by 10 a.m. to do prep for the Midtown lunch, but he decided to drive in order to swing by one of my clients after work. 2-year-old Basenji had suddenly started peeing everywhere, and I'd agreed to take the dog in for retraining. Though Paul made twice as much as the chef as I did as a part-time dog trainer, he always put our work on a par. So he left that morning at 8:45, in time to stop by the pet store on Broadway for more dog treats and kibble. He called me a few minutes later on his way into the store because on the car radio, he'd heard about the accident in the North Tower. We worried about David, uncertain which tower he worked in, while I hurried to switch on the TV. That was the last time we spoke. I forgot to say I love you. We didn't say that all the time. We didn't want it to get tired. I tried calling you, Sarah, but of course, the line was busy. Then the second plane hit, and that's when the horrible realization bloomed for us all that the first plane hadn't been an accident either. I've reconstructed the rest of the timeline, thanks to the Harrisons, about whose circumstances I now know more than I wish. I finally lost touch with the Harrisons, though they were almost tortuously attentive for a while. Along with their three kids, Joy and Buddy Harrison had gotten an early start after a long weekend upstate. At a lakeside resort they could only afford with post-Labor Day off-season rates. The day before, they'd shopped at discount outlets to stock up on sports socks, underwear, and family packs of chicken. With luggage as well, their rattletrap minivan was crammed. Around 9:30, they'd been inching down Riverside Drive, listening to the radio like everyone else. Traffic had been bad, and Buddy would be late for work, the kids late for school. No one had yet entered the universe where there was no work. There was no school. The news was distracting, upsetting, so it took them a while to notice that their engine was on fire. The Harrisons parked at a cockeyed angle at 79th Street and at least had the wit to drag their kids out before going after the economy-packed toilet roll. Buddy tried calling the fire department, but 911, the number didn't yet seem eerie, was no longer answering. Driving down Riverside to work, Paul would have spotted a minivan by the side of the road with flames licking from under the chassis. He was the only motorist to pull over. By then, everyone was already paranoid and doubtless assumed the van was a car bomb. The Harrisons are fiercely budget-minded, and even my beguiling husband couldn't get them to write off hundreds of dollars worth of discount products. So Paul helped them drag all their crap out onto the sidewalk while the fire got worse. Minding the kids, Joy Harrison sidled over to our Volvo, whose radio was still playing. That's when they announced that the Pentagon had been hit. Joy gasped. Buddy rushed over and they listened for a minute. Paul was still in their back seat. He must have been overcome by smoke. Then the whole minivan erupted. I'll take their word for it that Buddy and Joy streaked over to the van to pull my husband from the flames. But by then, Paul was badly burned. They tried calling an ambulance, but 911 was still jammed. Ironically, they could hear ambulances wailing down the West Side Highway the whole time, only 100 feet away. But the emergency vehicles were all headed downtown, not to some lowly car fire on Riverside Drive. This must have been right around the time you called me, Sarah. You were feeling so helpless. Unable to reach David's cell, the satellite networks were overloaded. We both gawked at CNN. Frightened personally, of course, but frightened also in a larger way that was unfamiliar. During one of our gaping silences, the South Tower emitted a great gray plume on screen and disappeared into smoke, like a quarter-mile-high magic trick. We inhaled together. We held our breath together. We screamed together. Sharing that moment cemented our friendship for life. I don't regret that. Meanwhile, I'm told, Buddy Harrison finally carried Paul to our Volvo to drive their rescuer to St. Luke's himself. But by then, traffic was hardly moving, and they must have lost a lot of time sitting in it. The hospital called me at 11:30. They may have tried to get through earlier, but I'd been on the phone with my mother, who couldn't stop weeping. "I don't understand," I said. "My husband had no reason to go downtown." Then a doctor got on the line. This was unusually personable service, but you remember, every doctor, nurse, and paramedic was on call, poised at every hospital in the city, and there was nothing for them to do, nothing. At least Paul Eisenberg's peculiar misfortune provided busy work. Ms. Eisenberg, I should clarify, said the internist. And then he delivered the verdict that would cordon me off forever, that would exile me in a small, tinny, unimportant world. A tiny, private, incidental world, while the rest of the country lived in the tumult of history, of shifting tectonic allegiances, of wars and counterinsurgencies, of great moral choices, grand speeches, and noble sacrifices. As far as we can tell, your husband's death had nothing to do with the World Trade Center. In New York City, 148 people die every day from strokes, traffic accidents, overdoses, or misguided acts of altruism. 10 years ago, my husband was one of them. But because he merely died on 9/11, I've been banished from the commemorations to which you've been invited for 10 years. Paul didn't burn himself in Shiso's kitchen, so I've received no survivor's benefits from workers' comp. While still childless, Paul and I had seen no reason to carry life insurance. Without a second income, I've had to give up the Upper West Side apartment. I sold most of our furniture. I'm stuck in a walk-up in Queens, where the supermarket signs are all in Chinese. I can't even afford cable. So you can imagine it was difficult for me when that victim's compensation fund awarded you $2.2 million, lump sum, tax-free. And you still objected it wasn't enough. It didn't reflect David's lifetime earning power. But Sarah, I lost my husband too. Yet no one's given me a dime, and I still pay taxes on every minimum wage dog walking check. Yeah, that's right. I've been reduced to dog walking. Everyone who died in 9/11 is described as a hero. If you don't mind, David did nothing but go to work. On his own initiative, Paul was helping a family in distress. Paul was a hero. David was a casualty. Yet David's picture was in the paper, not my husband's. David's passing is mourned annually by millions of people, but no one besides immediate family remembers Paul's. You've always emphasized how losing David was especially terrible because you have kids. Does that make you lucky? You've preserved your husband's very DNA. I have nothing to show for Paul. Some days I can't even remember what he looked like. Well, your children's faces remind you daily of David's. Remember, Paul and I had just started to try, and I cried myself sick near the end of that September when I got my period after all. You've been envious that I had a body to bury. Well, don't be. I may have taken possession of an incinerated corpse, but that body has never kissed me goodnight. Promised to pick up kibbles on the way to work. It hasn't proved good for much. You've sometimes strained to include me. True, were the first responders not all streaming downtown, where they would line up, bumper to bumper, pointlessly empty, maybe Paul could have gotten to the hospital in time to save his life. Maybe the Pentagon hadn't just been attacked, the Harrisons would have been more attentive and dragged my husband to safety. Still, I'm not officially a 9/11 widow, and I've never claimed to be. In some ways, that cataclysm has been the making of you. Before, you didn't even have a job. Now, you give speeches at fundraising lunches. You delivered a statement to the 911 Commission. You get letters published in the New York Times, which gives you special credence because of your bona fides. You attend the commemoration every year in smart black suits. You seem to know who you are now. While your children wear their heritage with pride, their father died in 9/11. You have fierce political opinions where before they were hazy, which has sometimes put us at loggerheads. I pointed out that the Park 51 mosque is planned near Ground Zero, not at Ground Zero. And I should know the importance of prepositions. You are offended. The mosque was insensitive, you said. But we can't ban a particular religion from a whole area of New York, I said. It's unconstitutional. You just kept repeating that word. Insensitive. I got the message. My opinion didn't count. Your opinion was privileged. Sarah, maybe that's what I'm trying to say. I know it doesn't seem that way, but you are privileged. Around the world, over 150,000 people die every day. From cholera, dysentery, cancer, starvation, war, or sheer neglect. Almost none of their families enjoy the widespread sympathy of total strangers that yours does. David's death means something, not only to you and your kids, but to the city, the country, the world. While all I can construe from the debacle on Riverside Drive was that my husband was a nice guy, the rest of us suffer our losses as deeply as you do, but can make nothing of them. We're left with no comprehension, no dark or larger concept like Islamic terrorism to locate at their heart, just an ongoing void and futile awfulness. We anguish alone and in silence. Our anniversaries are quiet, dolorous affairs, and the company with whom we share them dwindles. In primary school, a preposition was anything an airplane can do to a cloud. Since flying objects can apparently go through and even out the other side of tall buildings, perhaps a preposition is now anything an airplane can do to the World Trade Center. Whatever their definition, prepositions are powerful words. At Ground Zero, near Ground Zero, in 9/11, on 9/11. Our diverging fates have hinged on one letter. This year, perhaps you can finally afford some backhanded gratitude for that small I. Your life was shattered on an iconic shorthand, 9/11. Mine fell apart on plain old September 11th, 2001. Your losses filled you, made you greater, connected you to your neighbors in your country, and raised you to a select elite. My loss has diminished me, as losses diminish most people. I will still join you in spirit downtown this September, and I, too, will sorrow that night. As twin spotlights shoot, bend, and evanesce into the sky. But spare a thought for us exiles. The bereaved, for no grand reason. Your lot has been hard. But I believe my lot has been even harder. For a decade, the conceit of our friendship has been quite the reverse. Still with great affection, Rachel.
And now I'd like to present the author, Lionel Shriver.
This is Lionel Shriver, and I wanted to tell you a little bit about the short story, Prepositions. The title refers to the fact that the main character who's writing a letter to her friend lost her husband on 9/11, but not in 9/11. There's a big difference culturally. It's not as if the author is unsympathetic with the victims of 9/11. I mean, that almost goes without saying now. It was a horrible event. But every day in New York City, something like 150 people die. I assume that on the 11th of September, 2001, that was still the case. And there were any number of people who died of other causes on this fateful day, and their deaths didn't matter. I think I'm trying to make the case that losing someone is horribly painful, regardless of how they happen to die. And there's a way in which when we privilege certain deaths, it doesn't make it easier exactly, but at least it makes it seem more momentous. So I thought it was worth writing a story that in some ways, it's a memorial service, if you will, on 9/11 for the people who died in other ways.
If you're enjoying our podcast, we hope you'll join us for our monthly international live Zoom events where you can hear brilliant stories and meet our featured authors and actors. These events are free for annual patron and enthusiast members, and single tickets are also available.
Please visit our website at wordtheatre.org and sign up to become a member. You can become a free listener member or an annual paid enthusiast or patron. While you're there, check out our upcoming events, and you can pick up books by our authors at bookshop.org/shop/wordtheatre. This is Cetering Fox in Los Angeles.
And I'm Kirsty Peart in England. Until next week, signing off.